The second case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Pedro Garcia Chavez. For the appellant, Mr. Jeffrey Collins, an attorney from Rapid City, and Mr. Ken Duell, an attorney from Rapid City. Mr. Collins, I understand you'll be speaking for 20 minutes, and then Mr. Duell, the rebuttal for 10. Is that correct, counsel? All right, and for the State of South Dakota, Mr. Frank Gagan, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Collins, you may proceed, sir.
Please, the court, counsel. My name is Jeff Collins, and together with Ken Duell, we represent the defendant in this matter, Pedro Chavez. Excuse me. And to give a little procedural history of how my involvement in this case came to be, approximately 1 year out of law school, I was federally court appointed to this case, only to learn that Mr. Chavez was facing a mandatory minimum life sentence. And Mr. Duell was brought on board to help us out. As you know from the record, we were able to successfully suppress all the evidence in that case and have that case dismissed. Subsequently, Mr. Chavez was charged in state court with the same charges. He was convicted, suppression was not granted, and that brings us here today, which is my first opportunity to argue in front of this court. The three main issues in this case are the scope of the questioning after the initial stop regarding Mr. Chavez's immigration status, failure to Mirandize Mr. Chavez before questioning him about his immigration status, and the failure of the dog to alert on the car during the dog sniff, all of which led to the constitutional violation of Mr. Chavez. This case is a little different than a lot of suppression cases. In this case, we have a videotape evidence of his objective facts of what happened at the scene. We don't have to rely solely on the testimony of the officers to determine the credibility of the evidence in this case.
The problem is, though, I've watched that videotape, and the videotape, unfortunately, because of the angles of the cars, is not pointed at the defendant's car, so you can't really tell what Crockett the dog is doing when he's walking around the car.
And I would agree with that, but I think what's more critical than being able to see the dog is the fact, the audio portion of the tape. In that, as you are familiar with the case, is that after the supposed dog alert that Trooper Swest testified he received in his initial walk around, he tells absolutely nobody at the scene that his dog alerted to the car. He doesn't tell his fellow officers, he doesn't tell the defendants, he doesn't tell anybody. They continue doing an investigative detention, asking questions, things of that nature, and never ever discloses, yeah, my dog alerted. And as Judge Schreier put in her opinion, the most important thing in a drug investigation to tell your fellow officers is to be that your dog alerted to the order of illegal drugs on the car. And that didn't happen in this case. I think those facts coupled with his own conversations. At one point in the video, prior to the search beginning, Trooper Swetz and Trooper Schaefer, after finding a supposed fake Social Security card in the passenger's wallet, step off to the side, discuss what's going on. Trooper Swetz says, well, the passenger has a phony Social Security card. That gives us probable cause to search the vehicle. Never at that point, when he's in a private conversation with Trooper Schaefer, does he disclose, and my dog alerted to the order of illegal drugs.
Did the federal judges have the benefit of the expert testimony that the state judge had? I understand the dog trainer testified in the state proceedings, but did not testify in the federal proceedings.
No, the federal justices did not, our judges did not have that testimony. But again, I don't think it's relevant to their analysis. Their decision that the dog did not alert was based upon Trooper Sweat's actions after the dog sniff. The fact that he didn't tell anybody, that in other opportunities came up where he had an opportunity to disclose, my dog alerted. 20 minutes into the search, they're tearing the back seat of this guy's car out. Deputy Schaefer leaves. Trooper Sweat's still in the car. Trooper Thomas comes over and says, what do you think? Trooper Sweat says, I don't know. Mike thinks there's drugs here. Mike didn't have the drug dog. Trooper Sweat's did. So at that point, he still is not disclosing to anybody, while my dog alerted. This is after they're ripping the car apart, looking for illegal activity.
When was the first time that he actually indicated that the dog had alerted?
Never on the videotape. They do a subsequent search after the audio portion of the tape is turned off, where they put the dog in the trunk and it does alert. But the closest he comes to in the videotape is he's talking to Deputy Schaefer and they're questioning the passenger. And he's in a line of his conversation, he says, he's talking, and I don't remember the context before, but he says, Crockett showed some interest, but, and then goes on to continue questioning about other topics. That's as close as he gets.
Okay, so the first, and I've watched the tape as well. The first time then that he actually testify is when he testifies in the federal proceeding. Is that when he, that's the first time that, as far as the record indicates, that he says that the dog alerted?
He that's the first time he testified to it. He did put it in his report and his affidavit for search warrant.
Okay.
He did at that point say that the dog had alerted.
Did anybody testify other than the officers at the suppression hearing as to the dog's actions?
Trooper Thomas did. At the state suppression hearing, Trooper Thomas did talk about...
No, I'm talking the federal one first and then the state.
No, federal, the only testimony at the federal suppression hearing was that of Trooper Sweats.
Okay, and then you get more troopers only at the state suppression hearing.
We had the only other person that was on the scene was Trooper Thomas.
All right.
And he did testify about what he saw, but again, as was sustained in an objection, he's not trained with the drug dog, and his testimony was without foundation, and this court sustained that objection.
It was the state officers who made the arrest, right?
Yes.
How did this case get over to the federal government in view of the fact that it was in the county and it was the state officers who made the arrest?
Well, jurisdiction-wise, they had shared jurisdiction on that. It was a decision made by the state's attorney in Lawrence County based on the amount of drugs and the interaction with DEA, who came onto the scene shortly after the stop. And it was decided that the federal government would take on the prosecution for this
case. So the state's attorney, in essence, makes a decision to run this by the feds to get an adverse result. Then he makes a decision to run it through the state government, through the county government, and prosecutes them there.
That's exactly right.
Is I know we do have constitutional provisions on double jeopardy, but isn't there some unfairness in this sense? That here he's the matter is determined in federal court based on the state officer's testimony. Now the matter is determined in state court. Is determined first in federal court, then it's determined in state court based on the federal officer's testimony, and then based on the state officer's testimony, and based on the state officer's decision to have it be there for a second try. Is that right under the Constitution? Sorry.
Well, under the Constitution, there is the dual sovereignty doctrine, which allows separate prosecutions by separate
sovereigns. That permits it to happen.
We question that in that we think that there was significant state interaction with the federal prosecution, which would apply collateral estoppel and res judicata to those facts to prevent Mr. Chavez from having to run the gauntlet of two separate prosecutions. The protection that is designed, besides making him run the gauntlet twice, is that it's to prevent a change in testimony. If the state doesn't get a conviction the first time, or the federal government does not get a conviction the first time, then it allows them to go back, look what happened, and decide how they're going to prosecute the next one to correct that. That's what happened in this case, and I think the record's filled with testimony from Trooper Sweats at the state level that contradicted his testimony at the federal level. And he admitted he was able to review the transcript, review what happened, and plan around how to get around what happened at the federal court level. And I think that's the danger we have in this situation, and I think that's what came to fruition here.
Was the was here a situation where they could have taken him back into the federal court and tried one more time because it was just at the preliminary hearing stage that it was dismissed?
No. The suppression hearing order suppressed all evidence against Mr. Chavez, and the federal government chose not to appeal that decision.
The federal government or the state's attorney?
The federal government chose not to appeal that to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals.
And the reason, that sounds like maybe a dumb question, but earlier you were suggesting that the state's attorney was controlling the federal prosecution. Did I understand you to say that?
I don't think he was controlling. I think he was involved in the prosecution. He made the decision initially to allow it to go to federal court. His state officers were involved in the federal prosecution as witnesses and were the main players in the federal prosecution other than the federal prosecutor. And then when an adverse decision came down, he stepped right back in and said, we'll take it, and charged him with the same exact offenses.
Doesn't the dual sovereignty doctrine require that that state's attorney would have had to have controlled both prosecutions in order for there to be a bar?
I think that the case law supports that it has to be significant in interaction with the federal prosecutor.
Not just simply being witnesses or being involved. You essentially have to control the prosecutions, isn't that right?
I think that's fair, and I think that's why we haven't concentrated our argument on that issue so much in this case. I think the more important issues in this case are what happened at the traffic site, what's captured on the videotape, which is the best evidence in this case of what really happened. The scope of the questioning, Mr. Chavez was pulled over for a dangling object, a petty offense under South Dakota law. In accordance with in the videotape, it appears clearly that Mr. Sweats was after something more than a petty offense. He initially started questioning right away. He doesn't start to do anything to further the purpose of the stop. He doesn't start writing a ticket. He doesn't call in his license and registration. He starts questioning Mr. Chavez. Get some answers, and it's clear at that point there's a real problem with language. They don't communicate very well. So Mr. Chavez is having trouble understanding Mr. Sweats. Mr. Sweats is having trouble understanding Mr. Chavez. Mr. Sweats gets some answers from destination, purpose, things of that nature, and goes to question the passenger in the vehicle. He gets answers there, and at the end of his inconsistent answers, and that's one of the issues the state has raised, that Mr. Chavez and Mr. Castillo, the passenger, had inconsistent answers in those initial questions. That is not supported by the record. Mr. Sweats testified in both the federal hearing and the state hearing that those initial answers were consistent that were given about destination and purpose. So that argument goes away. Mr. Sweats then asks the passenger if he has a green card, which has nothing to do with this, the scope of this stop, the purpose of this stop for a dangling object.
Well, our cases and the U.S. Supreme Court cases, it permitted limited questioning at the scene. License check, registration, is there anything that prevents them from asking about alienage?
I think it's offensive to the, and not me, but other courts have held, that it's offensive to the Constitution to ask someone about immigration status. Your questions must be reasonably related to the purpose of the stop. Immigration status has nothing to do with ordinary traffic stops.
How is that any different than a registration check of the vehicle or a license check? Or any of the other things that are permitted?
Well, those things have to do with your ownership and ability to be driving on the roads. Your alienage status has nothing to do with that. And it's offensive to most people. It's going to be limited question, and in actuality, the people who are going to be asked this question are probably non-Caucasians. And so I think that it implicates the equal rights or equal protection doctrine also. If you're able to question people simply on the color of their skin about their alienage status in a simple traffic stop. And in fact, in this case, what happened after the determining that Mr. Castillo didn't have a green card, which he admitted, he never admitted he was illegal in the country, he simply said, I don't have a green card. Or responded to a question, I don't have a green card. What happened after that is what's offensive in this case, is the way and manner that Trooper Sweats approached Pedro Chavez following that gathering of that information.
And you're asking us to suppress because it's quote-unquote offensive?
No, I think it's a violation of Miranda. I think what happens after that, through the videotape, is that Mr. Sweats, who is 6'2", Chavez is about 5'8", Mr. Sweats is a big guy, comes up to him, has his license and registration in his hand, and Trooper Thomas has now arrived and is standing next to Pedro Chavez, and this is clear in the videotape. Sweats begins to interrogate Mr. Chavez about his alien status. He doesn't do it in a question manner, simple roadside conversation. He's demanding answers to his questions about his immigration status. In fact, he waves the license and registration in Pedro's face and says, just tell me the truth. Are you in the country illegally or not? And at one point, he's using double negatives. He says, you're not in the country illegally, which isn't even a crime. It's clear that this is interrogation. It's clear that Pedro's subject to a custodial interrogation at that point. He's not free to leave. He's got two troopers surrounding him. He's been told several times by Trooper Sweats to stand there, stay there, things of that nature. It's obvious a person, ordinary person, would not feel reasonable that he could leave the scene at that point. And we believe that, this is a violation of Miranda. he was asked to incriminate himself of a crime with these coercive questions in a threatening manner to say, I'm an illegal alien, at which point he did. Everything after that point should be suppressed based upon this illegal information. If Mr. Sweats runs the license, registration, they come back fine, Mr. Chavez is on his way.
When did they come back? I'm not clear on that. When? Because when I listened to the tape, I heard that traffic come back over the radio. At what point in time during this process did the license and the registration and all those checks, at what point were they completed?
Those were completed after that questioning with Mr. Chavez.
So wasn't the detention legal up to that point then? Because the cases are pretty uniform about license and registration checks.
Sure, but I think the manner in which he was approached, the circumstances surrounding that case, transformed this from a simple roadside questioning during the course of a traffic stop to run license registration into a custodial interrogation. No reasonable person would be expected to be approached the way Pedro Chavez was during a simple traffic stop, being yelled at, his things swung in his face, demanding he tell him the truth to incriminate himself in a crime. That's not standard roadside questioning. That's a custodial interrogation requiring the protection of Miranda, and that wasn't given in this case.
Had the officer asked him how many years he had been in the United States prior to this?
No, he had asked the passenger that question. Okay. He had never got that information from Mr. Chavez.
The passenger had been in the United States how long?
I believe 5 years is what his answer was.
And he had trouble communicating with him too, didn't he?
More trouble probably than with Chavez, but extreme trouble between all of them.
All right. So is it improper completely for the officer to investigate anything in relation to the immigration services?
I believe it is. I believe that he didn't have reasonable articulable suspicion from what he had learned at the scene prior to that to question Mr. Chavez about his alien status. It has nothing to do with the traffic stop. And at the scene, nothing had happened that would raise a reasonable articulable suspicion.
But if a man does not speak very good English, even though he's been in the country for 5 years, isn't that some indication that maybe there's an articulable suspicion that maybe he is in the country illegally? It's not a jurisdictional thing that the officer cannot ask about immigration status.
I believe that it appears to be offensive to me on the equal protection grounds if you're going to be able to pull over carte blanche anybody who's non-Caucasian who has trouble speaking the English language and be able to grill them about their immigration status. It for a simple traffic violation. This was a petty offense traffic stop. And the alien status has nothing to do with that stop. He was on a fishing expedition is how Judge Schreier characterized it in her order suppressing it in the federal court. He was going to look until he found something illegal going on in this case. And that's not what the Constitution allows. There's certain safeguards in the Constitution to prevent these actions.
Well, after the passenger indicated that he was not in the country legally, wouldn't that be a reasonable and articulable basis for him to ask the other occupant whether he was also in that status?
He never admitted, the passenger never admitted that he wasn't in the country illegally. All he answered to was a question, do you have a green card? He said no. That does not equate with being in the country illegally. I would guess that no one in this courtroom today has a green card. So that in of itself does not an indication that he was in the country illegally.
You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. And so after the Miranda question, that's when we get to the dog sniff, which is relied upon by the state and by Judge Johns to overcome any constitutional problems in these earlier interactions. They indicate the dog sniff occurred, and as I've discussed with you, it's not supported by the record. And Judge Schreier, in her opinion, again, stated the most important factor in a drug search or a drug investigation would be for an officer who has a drug dog who has received a positive alert to tell his fellow officers, we have a positive alert, there's drugs in this car. In fact, they wait, and I don't know the exact time, 7-8 minutes at least before they even start the search of the car. They continue their investigation for some time after the dog walk around, before they even go to the car, even though he knows, he's well aware, Trooper Sweats is well aware that he could enter the car and search as soon as he got the positive dog alert.
But now Judge Johns heard all the evidence, including 2 witnesses that the federal court did not hear, and at the end of the day found that the dog did alert. And you're asking us to say that that judge was clearly erroneous. Is that correct?
And I am, and I think in support of that, you have the videotape evidence of the trooper's action. You have the federal court opinion, which may not be binding on this court, but I do think gives some guidance to what she felt was important in this case. The expert's testimony is based on something he's never done before. He's a dog trainer. He said he's never graded or watched an alert or not seen an alert and just graded it on a sniff, or testified that he heard an alert based on the dog sniffing. You can't see, as you pointed out, you can't see the dog walk around the car. So he's relying solely on the noise of the dog sniffing. And he testified that he's never done this before. So I think that calls into question the reliability of that testimony. And I don't believe it changes anything when compared to the facts of Trooper Sweat's actions.
Thank you, Counsel. Your time has expired. Mr. Geegan, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. As you know, the present appeal stems from a traffic stop taking place in Spearfish, South Dakota on September 30th of 2000. During the ensuing search of the defendant's vehicle, officers uncovered a hidden compartment cut into the floor underneath the rear seat. Inside that compartment were several wrapped packages containing sizable quantities of illegal drugs. In all, officers recovered in excess of 450 grams of methamphetamine and over 18 pounds of cocaine. There was also in excess of 4 pounds of marijuana hidden inside that compartment. In order to properly understand or analyze the defendant's arguments, the state would submit that you have to look at the facts and circumstances leading up to the stop itself.
Trooper Can you Bryant, justify the activity of the officers based on what they eventually find?
Yes. There doesn't appear to
be... You can do that legally or you can do that morally?
Legally. There doesn't appear to be any dispute in this case that the officer had sufficient reasonable suspicion to effectuate the traffic stop. In fact, the defendant, in his reply brief, concedes that due to the dangling object, Trooper Sweats had reasonable suspicion to effectuate the traffic stop.
I don't think he disputes that. I think it's what happened after the traffic stop.
So what he focuses on is basically the length or duration of the traffic stop. His argument is that the trooper's subsequent questions regarding his immigration status didn't have any relation to the initial purpose of the stop, and therefore violated defendant's rights against unreasonable search and seizure.
In the testimony at the hearing, what did the officer articulate why he continued to question him? Was there suspicion? What kind of suspicion did he articulate after he received his driver's license, which was valid?
The officer was able to identify at least 4 separate grounds which gave him reasonable suspicion to prolong a stop.
And what were those?
The first suspicion, Officer Stroops testified that his initial suspicions were aroused based on the unusual nervousness displayed not only by the defendant, but also by the passenger, Castillo.
Although I'm assuming you watched the tape. There doesn't appear to be any nervousness on the tape.
Based on the angle of the camera, you cannot actually view the vehicle itself, so you can't determine what's taking place inside the vehicle at the time. All you've got to go on is Trooper Sweat's testimony that when he asked the defendant for his driver's license.
We see that on the tape.
Right, he testified the defendant's hand was shaking visibly, significantly. According to Trooper Sweats, both the defendant and Castillo were literally shaking in their seats.
Okay, now, so is that enough? Is that an articulable? I thought there's been some cases that this court has said that's not enough.
Right, but you have to consider that in combination with the other factors. Another important factor in this particular case, aside from nervous behavior, was the inconsistent or conflicting statements that the defendant and Castillo provided to the trooper regarding the trip from Seattle, Washington. The defendant told Trooper Sweats that he had been in Washington visiting sick family, that guy over there, and he pointed to Castillo. According to the defendant, Castillo was his sick cousin, and his family lived out in Seattle, so he went to Seattle to pick him up. The record, however, reflects that Castillo never lived in Washington. When questioned by the trooper, Castillo indicated that he lived in North Carolina. Castillo also never told the officer anything about being the defendant's sick cousin, nor needing a ride from Seattle.
And the officer knew all that at the time he was questioning him? And that gave him suspicion at that point on the scene? Is that
right.
What you're saying?
A reasonable stop or a reasonable investigation during routine traffic stop includes several things. He can ask the driver for his license and registration. He can request that the driver sit inside the vehicle while he runs a computer check to determine if there are any outstanding warrants.
He never had him sit in the vehicle, did he?
Exactly. And that's another fact that the state would submit is indicative of the fact there was no custodial interrogation. During that time, the officer can also question the motorist regarding his destination purpose. He can also question the occupants or passengers of the vehicle in order to verify information he obtains from the motorist. Now, if during that period the officer's suspicions are further aroused, the state would submit that it can prolong the stop in order to satisfy those suspicions. He doesn't need actual proof that criminal activity is occurring. All that he needs is reasonable suspicion.
What did he, back to my original question, did he articulate what criminal activity he suspected going
when
on?
When asked, Trooper Tess West testified that based on numerous factors, he suspected criminal activity, but he didn't know exactly what. When he was asked what type of activity he suspected, he testified that they were either in the country illegally or that they had illegal drugs in the car. The state would submit that under the circumstances, Trooper Sweats was therefore entitled to pursue those suspicions. He therefore went up to Castillo and asked, do you have a green card with you today? Castillo responded, no. The trooper thereafter asked, okay, do you have a green card? Again, Castillo responded, no. Based on those responses, Trooper Sweats returned to where the defendant was standing and asked, okay, because he, Castillo, says he doesn't have one, because he, Castillo, says he's not in the country illegally, are you in the country illegally?
Tell me about a green card. I'm unfamiliar with, are they required to carry them on their person at all times?
I believe it's like a driver's license. If you have it, it's on your person.
And that allows you to work in this country? Is that what a green card is?
Right.
And you are supposed to keep it on your person?
That's my understanding. I guess I'm not an immigration expert.
Could you be legally in the country without a green card?
Possibly, but I guess when Trooper Sweats, there was a reasonable inference at the time and at the scene that the defendant was not in the country legally based on the fact that he didn't have a green card, whether it be on his person or didn't have one that he could produce altogether. And like I indicated, the state doesn't need actual proof that the defendant was in the country illegally. All that the officer needed was reasonable suspicion.
What about this argument about the simple fact of asking about alienage because of a person's, the color of their skin or whatever?
The state agrees that there are a number of cases saying that you can't effectuate a traffic stop based on the fact that the individuals inside the vehicle appear to be some foreign ancestry. But that's not the facts in this particular case. The defendants conceded the officer had reasonable suspicion to effectuate the traffic stop. The state would submit that during the course of that stop, the officer developed reasonable suspicion which allowed him to expand the scope of his questions to include not only whether there were drugs in the car, but also specifically whether he was in the country illegally.
Based on alienage.
Right. The trial court found that the trooper questioned the defendant only after learning from Castillo that he was in the country illegally. According to the court, Trooper Sweats therefore had every reason to ask the same question of the defendant under the totality of circumstances. As was noted by the court, the defendant did not have any standing to contest or challenge the questions that were asked of Castillo. The rights bestowed in the Fourth Amendment of personal cannot be asserted by Carrison.
Mr. Collins said that Castillo did not say he was there illegally. How do you view the record?
The state would submit that based on the responses given to his questions, the officer certainly could have drawn a reasonable inference that he was not legally in the country. He was asked if he had a green card with him. He responded no. The trooper followed up with the subsequent question, okay, do you have a green card? To which again Castillo responded that he didn't. So when he returns, the defendant says, he's not in the country legally. Are you in the country illegally? The defendant responded that he wasn't. Even assuming for sake of argument that the trial court should have granted the defendant's motion to suppress, the state would submit that the defendant hasn't shown there is prejudice thereby. In denying the defendant's motion, the court stated, and I quote, I don't see what that has to do with the other statements. If I can suppress the statement that, yeah, he was not legally in the U.S., but that's still not going to affect my decision as to whether or not the balance of the statements should come in. According to the court, I'm not going to suppress the physical evidence in any event. He used a drug dog. He used a dog during the course of the stop. The trial court therefore found that the drug dog provided the officer with probable cause to believe that there were illegal drugs in the car and authorized the search. That then brings us to the other issue the state would like to briefly address here today, the use of the drug dog. It should be noted at the outset that the defendant does not and cannot challenge the use of the dog in this particular case. In fact, he again concedes that he has never claimed that Trooper Sweats was not allowed to perform the dog sniff during the initial time frame or that the timing of the dog sniff was unconstitutional. The defendant's only argument is that the dog did not hit or alert on a car. The state would submit that that was a factual question to be resolved by the trial court. Here the court, despite the defendant's assertions to the contrary, found that the dog did alert, thereby indicating the presence of illegal drugs. The defendant obviously would have this court ignore the testimony given by Trooper Sweats. Sweats testified that the dog alerted to the presence of drugs in the car. He testified that he heard the dog sniff increase intensify. He saw the dog's body posture tighten. According to his testimony, the dog hit on the trunk and he wouldn't move any further. Now, his testimony is corroborated by at least three other witnesses. The record reflects that Trooper Thomas was present at the scene. Thomas testified that because of the defendant's earlier admission that the dog would probably alert, he paid particular attention to what the dog was doing.
How do you answer then that he didn't bother to mention it to anybody really until the suppression hearing?
Two factors. The state would submit that since Trooper Thomas was present at the scene at the time the drug dog was employed and testified that he personally observed the dog hit on the vehicle, there was no need for Trooper Sweats to tell him anything.
But they didn't immediately go and start searching the car after there was a long period of time and further questioning about illegal status before they ever started.
Right, there's a number of reasons why the officer could have waited. Obviously, he had information, as he testified, reason to believe that they were in the country illegally or had illegal drugs in the car. There's nothing that says that he has to pursue the illegal drugs before he can pursue the question with regard to their illegal status.
Are there any objective tests that courts can use to tell whether a dog does hit on drugs, or are we really dependent upon the officer telling us yes, he did, or yes, he didn't?
I believe in this particular case, since the camera was not positioned so it could actually view or observe the dog go around the vehicle, we're pretty much left in the position of relying on the testimony of the witnesses who were there.
Different dogs alert in different ways, is that right?
Different ways, but pretty much it's the same standard response. Their sniff, their breathing intensifies, you'll notice a noticeable difference in their body posture, and some dogs will occasionally paw at the vehicle.
When I was a trial judge, I got to meet a couple of drug dogs, and as I recall, I got demonstrations on how they alerted, and some of them paw at the on the car. Or
right, but to train not to paw at the vehicle, because presumably that way they don't damage the vehicle, and then you look at some sort of civil suit, you know, by the defendant for repairs.
Okay.
In this particular case, the dog's trainer, Kyle Haney, testified that he had watched the videotape at least a dozen times. He testified that specifically at 2:17:08 on the clock monitor, he heard the dog's increased breathing, which had not been present during whatever else the dog was doing around the vehicle. There was no doubt whatsoever in his mind that the dog alerted. Finally, if you do look at the videotape, what you'll see the dog returning from the defendant's vehicle, and he's got a toy in its mouth. Trooper Sweats testified that this toy served as a praise or reward for an effective search, or successful search. Trooper Sweats testified that he never used the toy if the dog did not alert. According to his testimony, if he used the toy, that meant that there was an alert or an indication.
Does that invite the dog then to alert, whether to get his toy?
Again, I'm not...
No alert, no toy.
The last issue I would like to briefly touch on is the defendant's argument that the trial court erred in denying his motion to dismiss the indictment on grounds of collateral estoppel and res judicata. The defendant insists that this court is bound by the decision made by the federal district court to grant a suppression motion based on his finding that the dog didn't hit. The state would start with the basic premise that the decision whether or not to dismiss is entrusted to the sound discretion of the trial court. That ruling will not be disturbed on appeal absent a clear abuse of discretion. The defendant has not made that showing. This court in State v. West rejected a similar argument where it reversed the lower court's decision granting the defendant's motion to dismiss all charges based on this acquittal in federal court. In West, this court indicated that it's clear that the same act or transaction may violate both state and federal law, and that the conviction or acquittal in one jurisdiction does not bar the subsequent prosecution in another, provided that the criminal act is one over which both sovereigns have jurisdiction. Now, this dual sovereignty concept has been adopted in the vast majority of jurisdictions and continues to be applied. The defendant argues it shouldn't be applied in this particular case because he maintains that the state was somehow acting in privity with the federal government and therefore ought to be bound by its decision. In that regard, the state would submit that the trial court summed it up better than I ever could. When the trial court indicated in denying defendant's motion, there are no factors in this case which would lead me to believe from what I've heard so far that there was any privity between the state of South Dakota, the state's attorney's office, and the U.S. government in the prosecution of this case. According to the court, the fact remains that the only evidence I have before me now is that the state of South Dakota made its own independent decision to prosecute the case. In the court's opinion, the state's attorney did not have any control whatsoever over the prosecution of this other case, nor did that officer have any particular participation in the decision not to appeal the decision of the federal district court. The trial court therefore stated, I'm satisfied from all the evidence presented before me that there's been no control by the state of South Dakota over the federal prosecution, none whatsoever.
Well, how do you respond to Mr. Collins' argument that the Lawrence County state's attorney made the decision about the charge in federal court and made the decision as to what was going on in those cases?
The decision made was made to defer to the U.S. Attorney's Office based on a phone call that the U.S. Attorney's Office had made to Mr. Fitzgerald. Mr. Fitzgerald did not initiate the contact. The U.S. Attorney's Office wanted to prosecute the case because of the quantities of the drugs involved. Under the sentencing guidelines then in place, it was a mandatory minimum sentence of life imprisonment. So what they were looking at is prosecuting in federal court based upon the sentence that could be imposed.
So what actual involvement did the Lawrence County State's Attorney have in the federal prosecution?
None whatsoever, aside from deferring to the U.S. Attorney's Office to prosecute the case in the first instance. Mr. Fitzgerald testified that he made it clear that if it was unsuccessful, he would follow up with filing charges in state court.
He had no participation in the prosecution whatsoever?
No. He was never told or never participated in the decision whether or not to just file a motion for reconsideration or to file an appeal to the Circuit Court of Appeals for the suppression motion. He had no input or control as to what witnesses were called to testify during the federal proceedings. In fact, Mr. Fitzgerald is the one who had to contact the Federal District Clerk of Courts and get a copy of the Judge Fryer's order memorandum opinion to find out what had happened in that case. I realize there's plenty of time left, but unless there's any further questions from the court, the state would conclude by asking that the judgments and convictions be affirmed in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Gagan.
Thank you.
Mr. Duell, you have 10 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. We are here today on these three specific issues, and the state has candidly missed the most important one. It's not so critical, although I'm offended personally, and I think the cases are offended by the issue of alienage. It's not the fact that the question may be asked during a traffic stop, but it's the manner in which alienage was asked in this case. Under Myrie and the other cases that this court has had before it on a custodial interrogation, it's clear that prior to asking the critical question, are you in the country illegally, it's clear that before that, that Chavez was in custody. His car was blocked against the curb. He'd been ordered, and you see it on the video, ordered by the officer to stand here, stand next to this trooper, stay there. He went over to the car and got, let's presume, he got a belief that there might be criminal activities afoot, like in Myrie. The focus became the defendant. But instead of going on with a casual conversation, the officer took the registration and driver's license, walked back to the defendant, and said, are you in the country legally? Tell me the truth. Come on, tell me the truth.
Would that make any difference, though? If the dog did, in fact, alert, would it really matter what happened before that? The officers would still have the right to search the car once the dog alerted, if he did alert.
You bet. But I think that you have to go a long ways to allow this district or state court judge's opinion to be sustained under the clearly erroneous rule when you look at the video. Trooper Swetz can change his testimony. In the federal decision, he said there were two reasons, the nervous passenger and the broken English. If you look at the state court transcript, he changes testimony in 10 or 12 critical areas, including the dog alert issues. But if the dog alerted, we're in trouble. Our client's going to spend a long time in jail. But the evidence, the video does not lie. The video cannot change. The video is consistent throughout.
The inconsistencies in the officer's testimony between the federal court and the state court, those matters were brought to the attention through cross-examination in the state court proceedings, correct?
That's right.
So the trial judge got to weigh the significance of that inconsistent testimony of the officer.
Correct. But your job, as we all know, is to judge whether or not that was clearly erroneous. And I submit you cannot sustain that under the clearly erroneous because it's inconsistent with the video, it's inconsistent with the facts, it's inconsistent with the officer's own conduct. And that rises to the level of clearly erroneous. You cannot sit the trial court judge's opinion down and look at that video and say they are consistent, that the video and the opinion are consistent with each other, that the video supports that decision, because it does not.
Well, his opinion is based on a totality of all the evidence, not just that video.
The officer, his own testimony is inconsistent with the video. Does the trial court have a right to ignore an impartial, objective piece of evidence, the video, and rely on the subjective opinions of the officer who's got a second bite at the apple? I submit that violates the clearly erroneous standard this court's obligated to look at. I don't think you can sustain that. It's totally inconsistent.
So at what point should he have given him the Miranda rights, are you saying?
Just as in Myrie. Once the focus had changed from a general inquiry and trying to get a sense of what's going on in the field, when you get a focus that the defendant is now the subject of your attention because criminal conduct is afoot, you have an obligation to do Miranda, just in Myrie. You've confined him, you're focused on him, your intent is to create an answer that is incriminatory. Come on, just tell me the truth. The question is, are you in the country illegally, is an incriminating question. It has an answer, which is, if you are in here, this country illegally, it's a crime. You are a criminal. And therefore, Miranda should have applied. And the officer had no right under the Fourth Amendment or the 14th Amendment to ask that question in the particular setting of this case.
So you don't even have to... What's your view of how Terry interrelates with the right to ask this type of question during a Terry stop?
This is no longer a Terry stop, Your Honor. Terry has gone by the wayside when the officer comes back knowing that there's criminal conduct afoot and he's got this man secured and he's in custody. Terry, even though Terry is an in-custody perception, he is in custody for purposes of offering an incriminating statement. There's one purpose. Get the defendant to admit a criminal act. That's how it's different from the Terry line. It's more State versus Myrie, which you just decided last year. This is clearly an custodial interrogation. From that point forward, everything else must be suppressed. And I submit when you look at the video, you cannot, under the clearly erroneous standard or otherwise, support the decision of the trial judge. The decision of the federal judge is consistent with the video. It's consistent with common sense. It's consistent with logic. The officer says, well, my dog alerted, but I didn't tell anybody. Well, what did he do? He said, the other guy's got a fake ID. We could do a fake Social Security card. Maybe we can use that to search. Or even later, they're in the car. I mean, we're way beyond the issues of search and seizure. They're in the car. And Officer Swetz, still on the audio, says, Mike, Trooper Mike, thinks we got drugs here. Not my dog's alerted, or I think drugs are here. It's this other cop, who, by the way, the state court properly sustained the defendant's objection that Trooper Thomas could not testify that the dog alerted in the field. The state uses that as one of the basis for supporting the alert decision of the trial court. The trial court affirmed the defendant's objection that Trooper Thomas was not permitted to testify on that. So you have the video and you have Officer Sweats, and that's what you're limited to. Now bring in the trainer, Mr. Hayen from Iowa. 12 years he's been training dogs, and I'm not going to spend a bunch of time because I think it's ridiculous. The man says he's not an expert on audio alerting. He says he's listened to the tape 10 times, 20 times. I don't care what the number is. Listen to the tape yourself. You run it to 2:17:08, there's dead silence.
Did this man train the dog himself, though?
He did.
So he would, of all people, he would know if the dog did alert.
But he's never done this, a decision as to whether or not the dog alerted by listening to an audio tape because it's off camera. But if you listen to the videotape against his testimony, which says the dog inhaled, sucked in like a Hoover vacuum cleaner, you roll that tape to 2:17:08, and you've listened to it, and you'll listen to it again, I trust, it's dead silence. There is no Hoover vacuum cleaning. There's nothing out of the ordinary. The videotape is the objective evidence to this court. It's the videotape that supports the decision that the federal court entered. And whether or not you acknowledge that you're bound by it, you still have to look at it to see what does logic and common sense tell you. It tells you that that decision's consistent with the facts, that decision's consistent with the video, and that decision's consistent with the federal constitutional rights we're here today to assert. The state court decision is inconsistent with the video. It's inconsistent with the facts. It's inconsistent with all the evidence, and the trial court must be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Duell.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess until 11 o'clock.